Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the Eyewitness History Podcast. This is your host, Josh Cohen. It was on this day, August 17th, back in 1938, that there was an executive order on the law on the alteration of family and personal names, which required German Jews that bore first names of, quote, non-Jewish origin, end quote, to adopt an additional name. This was Israel for men and Sarah for women. The government required Jews to identify themselves in ways that would permanently separate them from the rest of the German population. All German Jews were obliged to carry identity cards that indicated their heritage. In the autumn of 1938, all Jewish passports were stamped with an identifying red letter J. As Nazi leaders quickened their war preparations, anti-Semitic legislation in Germany and Austria both paved the way for more radical persecution of Jews. It is in remembrance of this horrifying law that I want to present to you an interview that I did last year with Holocaust survivor Gene Klein. There will be a proper intro in the episode, but briefly to say that Gene Klein was a prisoner in Auschwitz during the Holocaust and was subsequently liberated by the Soviets. And now I give you Gene Klein.
What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
This episode, I have the great honor, pleasure, and privilege of speaking with Gene Klein. Gene Klein is a Holocaust survivor. In the spring of 1944, a teenage Gene Klein and his family were taken from their village in Hungary and thrown into the infamous Nazi extermination camp known as Auschwitz. His father was taken straight to the gas chamber. Klein was forced into slave labor until liberated by the Soviets in the spring of 1945. He spent 2 years as a refugee before his and other family members were allowed to immigrate to the United States. Klein has been speaking out about the Holocaust for more than 3 decades, writing for the World Post in July 2016 as a memorial to Eli Weissel. Klein noted that he, unlike Weissel, was silent for decades about the Holocaust. It was a real honor, as I mentioned, to interview him. Hearing his oral history, what happened to his father, how he was told about it, his experience is something that is indispensable to the telling of history, and certainly of that horrible but nonetheless important page of history. I hope you enjoy the interview. I hope you find it informative above all else. And now I give you Gene Klein.
Okay, I am here with Gene Klein. Gene, thank you for coming on the podcast, sir.
I am Gene Klein in person.
Here you are, huh? I'm delighted to speak with you. It's a pleasure, and if I may say, an honor as well. So I can't tell you how much I appreciate you taking the time for me.
Sure.
Yeah, I'd like Gene to start right at the beginning. I was wondering, could you please describe your life before the Holocaust? What was your family and your community like?
Okay, well, let's see. We were in the eastern part of Czechoslovakia in a town called Berehovo, which was basically, Czechoslovakia was born in 1918 at the end of the First World War, and they took a little part of Austria-Hungary, a little part of Russia, a little part of Germany, and here was this wonderful democratic country, very nice people from all over, you know. It was a bunch of people that, from anything from poor peasants to very rich people. My family consisted of my father, Herman, who owned a hardware, houseware store. Mm. And my mother, Bertha, was busy with kids and the home. I have had a sister, Lily, who was 9 years older than I was. and Olga was 6 years older. Unfortunately, both of my sisters died. They lived through the camp life against all odds, including my mother. So then the selection was in my hometown in, let's see, May of 1944. We had no idea where we were going, and we arrived to this place that was just thousands and thousands of people from our part of the country, and we didn't know where we were, what's going to happen to us. And when they gave the order to have the men and the boys to one side and the women and the children to the other side, and I was with my father, unfortunately, when we got to the front, where there was a line of SS officers, some of them in white coats, they must have been doctors. And they pointed to my father and sent him to the right, and pointed to me and sent me to the left. I had no idea what happened. I figured my father will be joining me. And I had absolutely no idea what happened to my mother and two sisters, because they were, you know, separate. As it happened, listening to my older sister, when she was talking about this part of her life, that when they got to the front of the line, she said to the SS officer who looked over my mother, before he made the decision of which way to send her, she said, Mutter, that means mother in German. Mm. And he must have had a little bit of goodness in his heart, because they sent both my sisters and my mother to live. Of course, from that point on, they had to go through the camps and so on and so forth.
Yes.
Fortunately, they survived, and they were liberated by the Allied forces, because they were somewhere in Germany, on closer to the, you know, to the west.
Wow.
While I was liberated by the Russians, because I was closer to the east. I was 16 years old when I was taken. Talking about my civilian life pre camp. I went to school. I went to so-called gymnasium. It has nothing to do with basketball. It's just a high school. And you go there for then you are from 10 until you're 18. And it's a little bit of middle school and high school and a little bit of college mixed up. So you were very well educated.
Sure.
In the third year of it, they asked you, not asked you, they told you that you have to choose two of the four languages that they offered. And, you know, you look at the map of Europe, all these little countries with the different languages. I could see why they wanted to do that. And they offered German, Italian, French, and English. And I took German and Italian. I don't know why, but I sort of figured that the German was it's a little bit similar to Yiddish. And I didn't speak Yiddish, but all the Jews did, and including my father and mother, if they wanted to talk about something that us kids shouldn't understand, they spoke Yiddish to each other, you know. So anyhow, basically making this decision about taking German saved my life, because later on I tell you what actually happened. If you're interested in pretty much of my life during the Holocaust, it is quite interesting and scary, of course, because, you know, after the selection, when my father went to one side and I went to the other, my life just totally changed, because I was waiting and waiting for my father that day. finally some food came, which was awful, but we ate it because we were so hungry. Our trip from home to this, what is it, awful, most awful place in the world, turned out to be Auschwitz. And all of a sudden, I'm waiting and waiting, and my father doesn't come back. And now I am with a whole bunch of people, not just from our country, but several other countries, in this huge barracks. We are given a place to lay down, a sort of three-leveled shelves, wooden shelves with a little bit of straw on it, and this is our new home. And it's terrible because now the Hungarian Jews are being shipped, so they have to make room for them. So they are squeezing as many people in these places as possible.
Yes.
And I wanted to find out, first of all, I didn't know what where I was. All I know is the same barracks. Barracks meant a lot of people and a lot of people in striped uniforms. And the trains are coming from Hungary, one after the other. Eventually, 400,000 Hungarian Jews were shipped to this place.
Oh.
Anyhow, I wanted to find out where I am. And I'm talking to a Polish prisoner, and he speaks German, and so did I now. I was fluent in German. And I asked him, please tell me how come my father went to one side and I went to the other side. I'm waiting for him. And he took me outside and points to this tall chimney in the distance, sort of belching smoke and sparks and, you know, flames.
Yeah.
And he says, just matter-of-factly, like we are talking about the weather, your father is going up the chimney. And I couldn't understand what this meant. And he says to me, you are in Auschwitz. This is the hell on earth. When the new shipments come in on the trains, I would say about 80% will be killed in the gas chambers. I said, what's a gas chamber? He said,
wow.
Oh, that's where they put you to kill you.
Mm.
So I had absolutely no idea about my mother and two sisters, but I know that my father is dead. And here I am, even though I am with thousands of people, I am alone.
Yes.
And I am in Auschwitz for 3 weeks, and they pick prisoners. We already got our striped uniform and everything else, and on my chest is a number. Finally, the last thing that I owned, my name, was taken away from me and gave a number, and from that point on, I'm not called by my name, just by my number. And I'm in Auschwitz about 3 weeks, and they start picking the SS officers. Everybody's standing in attention outside their barracks.
Right.
And he's just pointing to people, and you fall out. The only thing you have is a dish for soup or coffee and a cup. The dish is for your food, whatever it is, usually a very watery soup, and a cup, which is morning coffee. And then you get a little piece of bread, which will last you the whole day. And that's it.
Wow.
So they march us out to the same railroad station, which is right there in Auschwitz. Birkenau is the name of the camp. And we are put into the same kind of cattle cars that brought us to Auschwitz from my hometown. And there is a SS guard. He happened to be from Russia, I think. And he joined the SS when, you know, the Germans invaded Poland, Russia. And some of them just volunteered for being in the SS. And some of them wound up in camps as guards.
Wow.
And here he is in his SS uniform. He has a submachine gun on his chest. And he has a little milk stool, you know, three-legged stool he carries. And he goes up on the cattle car and sits down and takes out a piece of chalk from his pocket and draws a circle around him. And we are like 85 people to a car, which is like sardines.
Mm-hmm.
And he says in German, anybody who comes into the circle, I'm going to kill. And now knowing where we are, I know damn well that he is going to do it. You know, life is nothing now. Absolutely nothing.
Yes.
16 years old, and I was always loved and taken care of, and all of a sudden, just the opposite is happening to me, and I don't know just what's going to happen. And our train goes, and we stop after about 10 hours of being, I forgot to tell you that the trip from home to Auschwitz took 3 days and three nights. And the only thing, only meal we had was what was in our pocket, pieces of bread or fruit, and that was gone by the, you know, first 2 days. And we just starved on the third day before we arrived. And, of course, we didn't get anything to eat until that night after the selection was over. Mm. So it turns out that now I am in a slave labor camp. This is Wolfsburg. All this, I would say, 4,000 or 5,000 prisoners. Here they don't have long barracks, but circular sort of tents, you know, about 15 prisoners in each one. Each one of the tents has a little, one of those potbelly stove. It's made so it's not needed, but it's there. They gave us blanket, and the ground is covered with straw. And the tents are numbered, so you know which one is your home.
Mm.
And only four large buildings in the whole camp, and machine gun towers on the corners of the camp. If you get too close to the fence, you could be killed. So everybody is staying away from it. You learn real fast. And especially this self-preservation kicks in.
Sure.
And you want to make sure that you keep going. So you try not to look any different from anybody else. And the four big buildings, one was for the SS offices. One was the kitchen where they made our bread and our soup and coffee in the morning. And then we had the infirmary, which is deadly because whoever goes in there, chances are, will never come out because there is an SS guard at the door. And if you are sick and you go want to go in there, he will ask you what your problem is, and he will make the decision whether you are bad enough to be treated or just go back to work. And the fourth one was a latrine and wash, you know, just a pipe with holes in it where water was coming out so you could wash your face and your hands, and that's it. And then you have to stand up in five prisoners in a line in column, and they have a certain workload to be done. And what happens is that you start marching out of the camp, and there is an SS officer, and he has a list in his hand, and he knows that Site A needs 200 prisoners today.
Mm.
So he counts off the numbers, and a couple of SS soldiers and a capo. A capo is the go-between, the prisoners and the SS guards. They're usually German Jewish prisoners in prisons because they were all taken out of the prisons and sent to the assorted camps all over Europe.
Yes.
And so it turns out that our team went to the same station where we just arrived yesterday, and they have a whole pile of steel that they are actually going to be the steel that the trains will be running on, because it turned out that we are going to be building roads and railroads. And so it's a steel to be put down so the trains can run. And they assigned 3 prisoners to each steel rail.
Mm.
And it's, you put it on your, you know, on your shoulder, and one in the front, one in the back, one in the middle, and you start marching with it. Sort of a small elevation, so you, about a football field length. And you put it down, and then you go back and pick it up the next one and take it. So you basically become a robot. And the rails are extremely heavy, and your shoulder starts hurting.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-218-6010. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-218-6010. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-218-6010.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
So you switch it from one shoulder to the other shoulder.
Yes, sir.
And before you know it, your shoulders are bleeding, and you could hardly, you know, walk anymore. And you do this all day. They stop for about a half hour and give you some, you know, soup and a piece of bread. This is your break for the day. And you work all day from morning till night. And I go back to my tent, and I just, you know, collapse, because I'm thinking myself, how long will I last under these conditions? I never had any physical work done, you know, except helping my father in the garden. But this is awful, and it shows that your brain of a 16-year-old boy has graduated in one day to be a grown-up, because you figured out, if I'm going to go in column one to march out like I did today, I won't last, you know, but a few days.
Right.
It doesn't matter how many prisoners die, because the trains are coming with new prisoners from Hungary to replace them. So basically, the workers are about the same number, but in the meanwhile, a lot of people are dying.
Certainly.
So I figure I look just like everybody else. I have a blue and white striped uniform, but I'm not going to go to column A. There's column B and C and D and so on. They all go to different places. Maybe it's going to be a little lighter. Maybe it's not going to kill me so soon. So, next morning, I'm going to, let's say, column G. Okay, so, again, we just march out, and actually, I'm now working with a company of prisoners. They are smoothing the earth where the roads will be built, with 2 ditches, one on each side, for when it rains, you know, the rain would go into the ditches, not to halt up the work on the roads. So I figured this is terrible, because you have to work all day and
yes,
6 days a week, and it's morning till night, but at least I have a chance, you know.
Right.
So what's happening now, I'm going to just skip the awfulness of seeing the first person who died. I'm coming out that second day from my tent, and next to the opening of the next tent is a man, a prisoner, dead. Mm. And I look at him and I say, this man, whoever he is, will never see his family and loved ones anymore, his wife and children and friends and everything else. It was really gave me the strength to just keep going and keep going, because I have got to go home.
Yes, sir.
I figured I knew now that my father was dead, because he went to the gas chamber and then got burned in the, you know, in the ovens.
Yes.
And so things are going. It's now the fall of 1944, and I am also have been a skinny kid, and now I'm really skinny. And I am always looking for easier work, if possible, you know.
Yes.
And one morning, an SS sergeant, while we are standing in attention to be counted in the morning before marching out to our workplace, he says in German, is there any younger prisoners? Says, they're always there in the front part of the columns, because they were small and sometimes they are, can be seen because they are, you know, blocked by taller people and so on. So I'm in mm-hmm. the first row, and he says, is there anyone who speaks German? And I have a second of thinking, is this going to be one of those crazy things which sometimes they do with, to say, is there a carpenter, and when you fall out, they kill you.
Yes.
You know, so I figured if they're asking for one, they're not going to, you know, chances are small that they're going to kill me. So I put my hand up, and he says to me, all in German, and I talk in German, he says, come with me, and I go. And when we get to the gate of the camp, there is a civilian man, and he dismisses the sergeant, and he says to me, he introduced himself to me, which was so odd. You know, I am your prisoner. You are the one who can kill me at any moment, you know, and
yes.
and won't be punished for it. And he says to me, I am Mr. So-and-so. I'm a civilian engineer. I have to survey the road that will be built by you, you know, the prisoners, and I'll be here for 2 weeks, and I need somebody to help me with my equipment. With that, he gives me this wooden board with the numbers on it, and he has his tripod with his machinery on it, and he says, let's go, and we walk away from the camp. This is the first time in about 6-7 months that I haven't been with thousands of people, day in, day out, 24 hours a day. Mm. And I'm just going with him, and all of a sudden he says, stop here and face me, and he keeps going. He keeps going further down in this clearing. So here I am all by myself. I thought to myself, this is great. I wish I would be somewhere else. By myself, not in this conditions. And then he beckons me. So I, you know, take my piece of wood with the numbers and follow him. And this is what we do. Next morning, the first thing he says to me is, I see what terrible situation you prisoners are in. And my brain is questioning this comment. I mean, of course, we are being killed, you know, if not by outright killed, by labor we are being killed. I mean, are you trying to be funny or something? But the next thing is, what he says to me is this. Around lunchtime, we are going to be close to a forest. Very close to the edge of the forest is a barracks. This is a kitchen for the SS guards and the civilian engineers like I am, he says. And you go into the place, go all the way to the front, the very first table on the right, under the bench, there's something for you. Don't worry. Nobody is going to bother you because everybody is out on the work site. I go in and I look under the bench and there's a paper napkin and there is a piece of chicken, a piece of real bread that I haven't seen for months now, a little butter on the bread and a little cup of milk. So I drink the milk because I can't put it in my pocket and I put the rest in my pocket because I want to, I always, under these situations, you try to get them that you are friendly with for your brain to be a human being, some connection to somebody else. So I had a Polish kid that I was, you know, hanging out. We went to work together and stuff like that. So I come out and I thank him and I thank him and I thank him and I just can't get over, you know, that this thing happened. And I'm thinking to myself, if I would have taken English and German, I mean English and French, I wouldn't be in this condition. I would have died by now, you know. Wow. And the fact that I learned German basically saved my life for that point. I wasn't, you know, I had no idea if I'm going to be in these camps 2 more months, 2 more years, or whatever. And the survival of the prisoners are, when you go to percentage, I would say it's really against you. I mean, yes, more people are dying than are alive. And so now I'm back into the labor force because the 2 weeks are up. And I am digging a ditch on the side of the road, a drainage ditch, and as in pairs, 2 prisoners together working. The front one has a pickaxe and takes, you know, keeps hitting the earth so chunks come off. And the other one has a shovel. He takes the dirt and throws it out of the ditch. There are hundreds of us doing the same thing.
Wow.
Well, all of a sudden, when I hit the side of the wall, a piece of rusty wire, barbed wire, comes out and hits my thigh right in the middle, about 6 inches above my knee. And it goes through my my pajamas because I only have a very thin blue and white striped clothing. And it starts bleeding. And, you know, what's a little blood when you see so much death all around you? So it's nothing.
Yes.
But I started to get worried a little bit because in a couple of days later, it started to get a little bit swollen. So when I came back after the incident, immediately went to the washroom and tried to wash the blood off my leg and tried to hold some paper on it, you know, press it so it might help stop the bleeding.
Right.
And a few days later, I thought, well, I'm going to give it a try and go to the infirmary. So here I am. I told myself, I gotta let this blood flow, because if he just sees a little wound, he's not going to, you know, let me in.
Yes.
So I take off the scab and start pressing around it, and it starts, the blood runs down my leg, and I go to him and I stand in attention, telling him my prisoner number, and I said, I was in an accident. I cut my leg and I like to have, you know, somebody take a look at it. It was basically 2 doctors were running the whole thing with some orderlies. The 2 doctors were also Jews and they were prisoners also from Greece. And the problem with this hospital was that 80% of the people who went in never came out because they took the really, really sick ones, you know.
Yes.
And so I'm taking a chance. And one of the doctors looks at it and cleans it up and puts some powder on it and has paper bandages and wraps it around. And I say, thank you so much, and I'm going out. He says, where are you going? I said, well, I thought we were finished. He said, no, go up there. They show me where to go. Same kind of three-level beds and with numbers on it, and they send me to number 47. So I look for it, and I climb up, and I lay down, and the people next to you, you know, it's horrible because people are dying, and they're praying and crying and all sorts. This goes 24 hours. Mm. You know, I couldn't wait to get out of there.
Yes.
It was so terrible. And I am back to my rest of the workers, and we are having everybody outside standing to count everybody, make sure nobody escaped. Where would you escape? You don't know where you are, you know.
Right.
They would find you and kill you immediately. So you have to just stay there and try to, you know, just try to live from day to day. Now we are, you know, I'm back to work, and a man comes in. So, actually, it was outside. You know, we are standing outside the whole camp. And one of the SS officers tells you, Wolfsburg is finished with the work. In other words, we are not going to work anymore, and this whole camp will be sent to another camp.
Mm-hmm.
Those wow. who are able to march will march, and those who are too sick or too weak or whatever will go by. We have trucks coming. They will take you. Never, never, never. You learn that really soon when you are in the camp. Never get on any Nazi transportation.
Yes, sir.
That means that you are too weak, you can't work, why should they feed you? And the next thing is that you are in a gas chamber or being shot to death because you are not good enough. So I am still hurting the leg, but I'm going to march.
Mm.
So we are marching, and people are falling off because they thought they were strong enough, but they weren't, and they fall down. And the SS guard just put them on the side of the road, and one shot in the head, and that's it.
Wow.
And so it's scary. And the prisoners on the trucks, when they get to a fork in the road, the marchers go to the left, and the prisoners on the trucks go to the right. And I could bet anything that I have that they went to the nearest extermination camp, and they were killed immediately, because if they won't be able to work, why should we feed you?
Yes.
So, you know, as it turned out, Auschwitz had a death toll of 1,100,000, which included anything from children to grandparents from any European countries, mostly Jews, but a lot of gypsies and anybody that looked differently, you know, they had not white skin, and, you know, it was just people just, you know, don't realize how many is 6 million.
Right.
I have done a lot of speaking all over the world the last 40 years, and I will definitely send you a book because it, you know, it explains in detail how this thing is, you know, what was and how terrible it is that people, there are people that saying there's no such thing as the Holocaust, or instead of 6 million, only 3 million were killed.
Right.
You know, stupid people. And it's scary, you know, that why should, you know, the fact is that if one person came back from a family, that was already a miracle. In my case, you know, I told you I didn't know anything about my mother and two sisters. They were working in an ammunition factory, and more of the women prisoners died from aerial, you know, Allied bombings than anything else, because they were further to the west. and a lot of Allied bombings went around in that part of Germany. And the guards said, well, you know, the siren said that the planes are coming to bomb. The guards went into the bunkers, and they said to people outside, you know, just go into the ditches. So I will continue. Tell me what is a good time for you.
Yes, sir. I might need to look at my schedule and email you, if that's okay.
Yes, please.
Certainly. First off, thank you so much, Gene, for this story. It's truly horrifying. Yes, sir. We'll pick up in a second interview. And at that point, what I want to do is I want to discuss certainly liberation, how it felt after you were liberated from Auschwitz, your life after the Holocaust. I certainly want to.
Great.
Yes, sir. I'd like to discuss the book and then obviously where you stand as a speaker. Yes, sir.
In the meanwhile, you can go online and just put in Gene Klein, Holocaust survivor. You'll find a lot of interviews.
Yes, sir. And I'd encourage our
And my daughter will be on some of them. And she's the one that wrote the book.
Perfect.
It was great talking to you.
Thank you so much, Gene Klein. It was an absolute honor, and we'll be in touch soon for part two.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode. For more information on eyewitness history, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen, and James Early's Key Battles of American History, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.